Interview with Alan Rosenblatt, June 12, 2007, in Washington, D.C., by Kenneth Durr.
I want to start, take you back to Chicago. Looks like you went to school there. Were you a native of Chicago?
No, actually, I was not. I went to college, University of Chicago. College, that was in the Hutchins days. I don't know whether you remember Hutchins. And that was in the waning years of the Hutchins days. And then I went to the college, and then I went to the law school. And how I got there is very interesting, because when I went to high school, I studied photography. And I didn't take any math or languages. And so when I ended up in New York, ultimately, because we were living in Buffalo, but I was in the Navy for a couple of years, when we ended up back in New York, I thought I would go to night school and get some credits in languages and math. And, of course, I never got around to that. I was working in a photo studio, and then a friend of mine, best friend from my boyhood in Buffalo, came to New York, and he said, "What are you doing in this darkroom?" And I told him that I would like to go to college, but I didn't have the credits. And he said, "I'm at the University of Chicago. There are no academic requirements except a high school diploma. And you can take an entrance exam. You can take it here, and if they accept you, you go to Chicago." And Chicago then had a very interesting system, which was they did placement examinations. When you first got there, they gave you a series of examinations in the arts and in the humanities, and including music and literature, and I did pretty well on those things, because I guess I was 23 years old, and I had always been a rather bookish person and read a lot and was very interested in art and studied color theory and paintings. And so I did pretty well. So as a result of that, I had only to go to college for 2 years and a quarter. They were on a quarterly system then, to get my bachelor's degree, which was fine, and I did extremely well. I graduated with general honors, which meant that I had more A's than B, all A's and B's, and more A's than B's. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, that meant that my years at the University of Chicago College were not enough to satisfy the Phi Beta Kappa requirements, so I didn't make Phi Beta Kappa, although some of my law school classmates did. Anyway, I went to the law school. I did pretty well. I got on the law review, and then someone who died very recently, one of the professors whom I never took a course from. If you were on the law review, he would help you. And so he knew somebody in New York, and he found this law firm in New York. In the meantime, I had already gotten a job. My tax professor actually got me a job in Chicago, and I was all set to do that. And it was winter, sort of in between quarters. I was in Chicago in the dorm, and I said, "You know, why are you in Chicago?" And the answer was, "Because your mother is in New York." So I said, "Is that a good reason?" And the answer was no. So I packed up and went to New York. And in the worst time of the year, although I had gotten some introductions from the dean of the law school, who was Ed Levy, who later became attorney general, I guess in the Reagan administration. And so he gave me some letters of introduction to some judges in the D.C. courts, but I apparently didn't excite any interest there. And so I was sort of stranded in New York, living with my mother. And and studying for the New York bar. And so ultimately, and then I got this, so I got this job, and I did some, I was really very naive in the ways of the world because I didn't tell the tax law professor that I had done this. And he found out that I had left town without taking this job, without telling him. He was really very angry at me. But luckily I had this other professor who liked people who were on the law review.
What was that law firm you
it was
got?
The name of the law firm was Hellerstein & Roser. It was a small law firm. It had two partners, and then they made one of the associates a partner, and they did taxes, corporate taxes. And I thought, I liked that because I was so frightened when I took the tax course at the law school, I was so frightened that I studied more for that than anything else.
And did you have any sense that you might specialize in corporate or securities law?
No, none whatsoever. None whatsoever. So I ended up, and they a specialized, small law firm, and they specialized in the consolidated financial statements. And their main client was a large public utility holding company that actually owned the company that owned the Three Mile Island reactor, although that was way before. Mm-hmm. And so we did. So I worked there, and I liked it very much. And I liked doing tax work because it's a discrete body of law, and you don't have to worry about some oddball state law decision that you have overlooked. And so then a friend of mine who had also gone to the University of Chicago, who was a year ahead of me, named Marvin Cherelstein, that's C-H-I-R-E-L-S-T-E-I-N, who was at Wilkie Farr. He was studying the bar also, and he... there was somebody in Chicago who wanted him to come out and work and do tax work in-house at this corporation. And Marvin didn't want to go to Chicago because his mother was in Chicago. Actually, she had a seat on the Chicago options commodities or options exchange. And so he put me on to this fellow whose name is Daryl, D-E-R-A-L-D, Ruttenberg, who had this small company. It was Ruttenberg and two other guys. One of them was an accountant, although very flamboyant accountant. He owned two Stradivariuses, a violin and a viol, I think. And he played the violin himself, and he liked to do string quartets. The third guy was a guy named Keith Kindred, K-I-N-D-R-E-N-D-E-D, who had a municipal bond house, and one of the guys, I used to go to lunch with some of the guys that worked for him, and one of them said, "Don't tell my mother I work in a bond house. She thinks I work in a whorehouse." So anyway, and he financed their ventures, which were directed to buying up distressed companies, taking control of distressed companies, and then liquidating the assets. And the one that I was with was a company that was a brewery, and they owned a brewery and some valuable real estate in Chicago, and they also built their own trucks. The name of their truck company was the Available Truck Company. And so they liquidated that and made a lot of money selling the real estate. So I found out that I had come to I had come out to Chicago to replace someone who was working there who was very bright and whom he was dissatisfied with. And it turned out that Daryl Ruttenberg was looking for another Daryl Ruttenberg, and there wasn't any. And if he ever found one, he wouldn't be able to get along with him anyway. So he, after maybe a few months, he discovered that I was a pedant, and I did good, boring research, but I was not imaginative, and I could not think. I was not a deal maker, which was the furthest thing from my mind. So I ended up working for the guy that I came out to replace, which was okay, and it was very good because I learned how businessmen think from that experience. For example, they took over an iron foundry in Michigan, and I guess it was Milwaukee, and they. So the legal question I was asked to research was, we're taking over this iron foundry and they use a lot of sand, and a lot of the workers develop silicosis through the years of working with the sand. Would it be legal if we fired everybody who had been there for a long time to avoid liability for silicosis? And I guess, unfortunately, the answer was, at least the answer at that time was, no, it wasn't illegal. So that was one little insight I got into the way these particular businessmen thought. They were honest. I mean, they didn't do anything. The fact that they asked me to research it showed that they were honest. And so I did a lot of very routine corporate work, filing, doing, tax returns, state tax returns, and the like. And then the three of them decided to split up, so they didn't really need two people full-time on their legal staff. And so it looked like I'd have, they didn't ask me to leave, but it looked like my job was not long.
Yeah.
To go, and so I had, by that time, my friend Marvin Chilstein, who got me out to Chicago in the first place, was working at this large Park Avenue law firm, Kay Scholer. It was at Kay Scholer, Fearman, Hayes, and Handler. I don't know what they call themselves now. So I had tried to get a job with them before, but had not gotten in, but they were expanding rapidly, and they got me in on a weekend and interviewed me and offered me a job on the spot. And I didn't realize that the person I was talking to was Mr. Hayes of Kay Scholer, Friedman, Hayes, and Handler, and not the hiring partner. And the hiring partner was annoyed that they had hired me without his knowing it or without his presence, which didn't bode well for my relationship with him. In any event, I did some very interesting work at Kay Scholer, ordinary corporate work.
Right.
And then it didn't look like I was, and I was there for, it's almost maybe 4.5 years. And it didn't look like it was going anywhere. So I decided that I really had to get out. And I had a friend whom I had known before, who had worked at the SEC. And he said, the place for you is the SEC.
Who was that?
His name was, it'll come to me. I can't remember it at the moment. But he had worked at the SEC, and he said, go to the SEC. And so I went to New York, and I interviewed in the New York regional office, and they offered me a job because I had had, by this time, I had almost 10 years of experience as a lawyer. Nicholas Wolfson was his name. But Wolfson said, New York is okay, but they don't, their pay grades are limited and not as good as in Washington. So go to Washington. Okay. So I arranged for an interview in Washington. And at that time, they had, they had an examination, an actual examination of a securities law problem that had to do with charitable organizations and whether they would be recognized as charitable organizations by the IRS. And so, in the morning, you wrote the exam, and then after lunch, you came back, and there was an interview group. And they interviewed you, and they looked at my exam, and they said, you did very well on this examination, and we are going to send you around to interview some other people at the commission. So they sent me to the Office of Opinion Writing, and then the Division of Corporate Finance, Corporate Regulation, later became Investment Management. And I first interviewed at the Office of Opinions, and they wanted writing samples. And I felt that that was somewhat demeaning after I had had 10 years of experience. I just waited for the next interview, and I interviewed in the other Division of Corporate Regulation, and there I found someone who was to be my mentor. His name was Solomon Friedman, we took an instant liking to each other, and so he offered me a job, and I took it, and I can't now. I took a pay cut. I was making about $13,000 at Kay Scholer, and I went down to a little more than 11, but it was enough to live on. And so we moved to Washington, and my wife and my first child, my son, and. And then I worked in the division reviewing applications for exemption from various provisions of the 40 Act, you know, learned about the 40 Act. And then there was an opening in the chief counsel's office. And I don't know whether I applied for it or they asked me. I think they asked me. And I ended up working in the chief counsel's office, which was really a great place to be. At that time, the chief counsel's office did rule proposals and considered comments on rule proposals and did the final rule release and also no action letters and interpretations.
How long were you in the investment company?
I was there from 1960 to 1976.
Okay, so when you moved,
maybe it was 64, 60.
Yeah, I have you coming into the SEC in 64.
Yeah, 64. 64 to 76,
so
right.
So when you went into the chief counsel's office, this was in the division of the...
A division of corporate regulation, right.
Which dealt with investment companies.
Right, right. And the investment of... Later, the Investment Advisors Act.
Right.
Not
at that point, though.
Yeah, no, that was later. Casey came in and reorganized the whole thing. I will tell you a little story about that shocking event. In any event, so then the assistant chief counsel left and I became assistant chief counsel, and then there was an opening for the chief counsel with whom I got, his name was Frank Kelly, and he went out to California to be in-house counsel with somebody, and So he left and there was a vacancy. And then at one point, you know, one of the nicest things that ever happened to me in my life was I was called into Saul Freeman's office and he said, "We now have a new chief counsel." And that was really great. And that was, I think maybe in some ways it was the best job I ever had at the commission. But there it was, and I had three or four people working for me who were really bright. One of them was Marty Liebecker. And he was really great. I mean, one of the commissioners whose name escapes me, but it will come to me, used to say, if you want to do well, hire people who are smarter than you are. Right. And that was Marty Liebecker. Marty Liebecker, with whom I still keep in touch, knows everything and remembers everything. And he remembers things that I did that I have forgotten.
Remembering is the trick.
Right. So then I was there. And then one day I was called up to the chairman's office. That was Rod Hills was the chairman.
Okay.
Roderick Hills.
Yeah, and moving ahead a bit.
Yeah. And he called me up to his office. That's the first time I ever sat in the chairman's office talking to the chairman. And he said, "There's something that I would like you to do. I would like you to go to the general counsel's office for a while. You know, you don't have to go if you don't want to, just for a little while, and then you can go back to where you want to go." And that was a shock because I knew very little of the general counsel's office, although I knew they were all very good. And then I asked around, and everybody that I asked said, "The general counsel's office is the place to be. You ought to go there." So I went there. Now, I think that, and then Harvey Pitt, who was then, I guess he was general counsel then, he wanted to have people from the divisions working for him so he would know what was going on in the, you know, what the law was and what the pros and cons were of the things that the divisions were proposing and doing. And he got, I guess he got one other person to come up. And I guess the guy from market regulation, then known as Division of Trading and Markets, refused to go. And I didn't know he could refuse, but he did. And Harvey was a very hard taskmaster, very, very hard, very critical, very hard to work for. And I did something that I never wanted to do, which was appellate litigation. Now, I had done some appellate litigation at Hellerstein when I first got out of law school, and I wrote a brief in a case that we actually won about $1.5 million in this case from the government.
Why didn't you want to do it?
I didn't want to do it because the deadlines are real. And you have to write briefs, and then depending on the difficulty of the brief and who was reviewing it, and it was always Harvey, with some exceptions, and how long it would take to get it reviewed, and what would happen if you got it reviewed, and I know that, Harvey would well. I won't. Harvey, at least on one occasion, I had worked on this brief and given, which was due on a Monday, and I gave it to him on a preceding Wednesday, and I kept asking him, you know, how is it? And then, he called me in on the Saturday or Sunday before the brief was due and wanted me to, didn't have any real, he had some criticism, but not, but the only real thing he wanted me to do was put the first part at the end and the last part at the beginning. Now, we had no word processors. We used to do cut and paste. And it was really very difficult. Of course, I did it, and it was fine. And so that's one of the reasons why, and I did actually did two or three oral arguments. I did one, and I hated that too because it's very nerve-wracking. But when you get up there, there is nothing like it. There, I went to an oral argument in San Francisco, and the question was, can a corporation assert the right against self-incrimination? And the clear answer was no. And as a matter of fact, and the morning of the argument, I arrived at the courthouse early, and found out who the judges were. And one of the judges was Justice Clark, who had been on the Supreme Court, was then doing the circuits, and he was sitting on this Court of Appeals in California, and I quickly did some research in the cases that I had looked at, some of the cases that I had had in my brief, and I discovered that he was Attorney General and wrote a brief in a case that I had cited. So when I got up to do the argument, you know, that there is no right against self-incrimination by corporation, I said, well, in the XYZ case, which Justice Clark won, they held that there isn't any right against self-incrimination by corporations. And later on, when one of the other judges questioned me, he interrupted and said, oh, that was decided in the XYZ case that I won. So we won that case. So, you know, there's nothing like doing it, but working up to it can be torture. Yeah. Well, then ultimately they got somebody who actually had been doing legal, who knew lawyers' work, you know, how to organize lawyers' work, and he didn't know anything about securities laws, but he knew law office organization, and he recommended that they break the office down into appellate litigation and counseling, which involved reviewing memos that the division sent to the commission, either for enforcement or for rulemaking, and he had interviewed me, and he knew that that's what I wanted to do. So then Harvey left, and Ralph Ferrara became general counsel, and I worked for Ralph, and that's when I really started enjoying it, because you know, if any question involving the Investment Company Act or the Investment Advisors Act arose, I could advise Ralph, you know, what position to take, and same thing on legislation, you know, many, I left out one very important, extremely important thing. When I was in the Chief Counsel's office, the Commission recommended what became the 1970 amendments to the 40 Act.
Right.
And I did a fair amount of work on it. The work was mostly done. Dick Phillips in the General Counsel's office had worked on it. But I did something, you know, toward the end, you know, went to the hearings, wrote some of the testimony. And that was really a lot of fun because ultimately it passed.
Right.
Although if you read the book, I forget what, it's a book by somebody who took over from Loss's practice.
Yeah, Seligman.
Seligman. Seligman, if you look in Seligman's book,
yeah,
you see that the 70 amendments, you know, didn't do anything. It was
right.
It was a failure. That is totally wrong.
Yeah.
As many Investment Company Act lawyers will tell you, it made the whole thing different.
Well, I want to approach that from the other end.
Yeah, okay.
And I want to jump back a little bit.
Right,
we got you into the SEC and through the Assistant General Counsel.
Yeah.
Jumping back, even before you came, I was intrigued to see during your Kay Scholer time, you were involved with a case called Katie Roberts.
Oh, yes. Oh, I should have mentioned, yes.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for mentioning that.
Now,
yes.
Did you know you were in a landmark?
Thank you. Yeah. As a matter of fact, the first few words in that case were, this is a landmark decision. That was Carrie who did that. Yes. Thank you for reminding me. Yes. I remember I was in my office in the chief counsel at Kay Scholer, and somebody came into my office and said, oh, this was the guy whose son later went to the commission. I forget his name, but it may come to me. And he said to me, what would you think if somebody had some information that was very valuable about a company, and you knew some of your clients, you're a broker dealer, and some of your clients had stock in this company, and you had discretion to sell their shares in this company, and you knew that the stock, as soon as this information became available, the stock would go way down. And you did that, would that be illegal? And I said, absolutely not, because there's no face-to-face dealing. Someone who doesn't know the other side and trades on an exchange has no duty to the other side of the trade if he trades on what later became inside information. So now, this was very interesting because the New York Regional Office had brought this case. It was an administrative proceeding. And someone had already settled the case in terms of liability. But the only thing that the settlement said, we'll only do the penalty phase of this. So you be ready to defend the penalty phase. Now another party that represented, I think, the guy who actually did the thing. He later went into the mutual fund business, by the way. But anyway, he did not settle, and so his part of the case was arguing that it wasn't illegal, and so he did that. And the general counsel of the commission, who Philip Loomis, who later became a commissioner, argued for the commission, and I forget who argued for us. But anyway, in our brief, we said, you know, this is unprecedented. It's not a face that we found no case in which there are not face-to-face dealings. And so it couldn't possibly be illegal. And as you know, the commission held otherwise, and that was the Katie Roberts case. Now, I will tell you something about the Katie Roberts case.
Mm-hmm.
And I've mentioned this before in public fora. They had a director's meeting, and there was a guy that was it was Curtis Wright, and Curtis Wright was doing badly, and it cut its dividend. And was paying dividends out of past earnings. And so they were going to cut, but they had not cut the dividend. They were still paying dividend out of past earnings.
Mm-hmm.
And the question at this director's meeting was, shall we cut the dividend? And so they decided to cut the dividend. Now, the New York Stock Exchange rules at the time required that you send a telegram to the New York Stock Exchange to appear what they call the broad tape, which is, I guess, the Dow Jones
right.
News Service tape, saying that you'd cut the dividend. And so then after they decided to cut the dividend, they had a short restroom break, and during which time the secretary of the chairman of Curtis Wright went to type out the telegram, but she was not in her office. They were having this meeting in someone else's office. And none of the secretaries would let her use their typewriter. Until finally she found one, and she typed out the telegram, and they sent it. But by that time, the guy at Katie Roberts had already done his inside trading. Now, it is quite possible that if she had been able to find a typewriter, then Katie Roberts' case never would have happened. But anyway, the guy's name was Gintel, G-I-N-T-E-L, and he later went into the mutual fund business. And so he called his trader, the trader at his firm, and he said, and he couldn't get the trader, but the trader's name was Bob, and he said, tell Bob we cut the dividend. So then the trader knew immediately, sell out. Now also, another interesting wrinkle was that there was a New York Stock Exchange rule was that if you sold short, you had to label it short. But they didn't label it short because they were selling what they call against the box because they owned the shares. They actually had the shares in discretion.
Okay.
So it was a sale against the box. And so so one of the things that happened was they didn't sell market short. And then the New York Regional Office was investigating this sudden drop in the shares of Curtis Wright, and they, you know, went through everything and finally found a client. But it's interesting that they knew that there wasn't any law on their side, and they had to go to the commission, and Chairman Kerry came through for them.
Yeah, and the rest is
yeah.
history.
Yeah, actually, one of the reasons why I got hired at the SEC was I told them that I had worked on that case, I remember being in a seminar with Loomis that he held on interesting issues, and the question he raised was, suppose the information you had was not really information about the company, you know, the working of the business of the company, but just market information. Information, for example, that one of their directors or officers was going to sell out his shares. Would that violate 10b-5? And Loomis said, no. And the commission ultimately said, yes.
It took them
that shows how the law develops in very unexpected ways.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, let's go into the Division of Investment Management.
Okay.
You talked a little bit about coming in at the beginning learning about the 1940 Act, Investment Company Act and Advisors. My sense is because you've got that completely different set of legislation from the 34 and 35 acts, that there's something, you know, that there's something different about that division, the kind of work, and even the kind of culture. Yeah. Did you find that?
Oh, yes. Well, as I said before, we didn't have the Advisors Act until Casey reorganized the division. And that was a shock because I went home on a Friday, and when I came in the following Monday, my office was gone, and all that there was the iron supports for the plasterboard, And I didn't have a phone connection to my secretary, so I went out and bought some toy walkie-talkies. And I used to call her on the walkie-talkie because I couldn't see her from where I was. So, and that was interesting. We got the Advisors Act, and that's when I started to learn about the Advisors Act, which was a whole new thing.
Okay.
Yeah.
But when you first went, you had the Investment Company Act.
Right, yeah, right. And I didn't have the 34 Act. Very little of the 33 Act, although I had done, you know, I had done a few filings at Kay Scholer, 33 Act filings. And I still, you know, I still don't consider myself an expert on the 34 Act. I'm a little bit more comfortable with the 33 Act, but since what I currently do doesn't involve the 33 Act very much directly, I know about it. I can go through, you know, I know a fair amount about it. But
the 1940 Act is another matter.
That's it, right? Yeah.
Now, when you came in, it had only been a short time since there had been a study done by the Wharton School.
Right. Yeah, that's right.
Was that influential? Did you hear about it? Did you study the findings?
No, I think Phillips and some of the people who were left over. Well, there was the Wharton study, and then there was a special study.
Right.
And so the special study came after the Wharton study, right?
Yeah.
And there were still some people who had worked on the special study. And
that would have just wrapped up about the time you came in.
Right, right. Yeah, and so, and of course, the 70 amendments built on the special study, but was a whole different kind of exercise. We went through two full sets of hearings. And as a matter of fact, it almost went down the drain. And Hamer Budge, who was a conservative Republican, who knew Richard Nixon when they were both in the House of Representatives together, that's how he became chairman. He was in was something called, I don't know, it was the Nixon something Chowder and Marching Club. He belonged to. And so he had been persuaded that the 70 amendments, what became the 70, were worthwhile. And when he heard that it wasn't, no one was pushing it, even though that we had two full sets of hearings, he became very upset. And one of the commissioners who came from Congress, I think it was a representative, I can't remember his name, he sent this guy over, and he used to walk the halls and buttonhole people or go into their offices and try to persuade them to push the 70 amendments. And that's how it happened, because Hamer Budge was very upset and really believed in it and was told it's not going anywhere, no one's interested in it, there's too much to it, it's too hard to understand. And that's how it happened. And one of the interesting things that happened in the 70 amendments was this question of Section 36B, which imposes a fiduciary duty on investment advisors for the amount they receive in compensation. We could not get the fiduciary duty into the amendments approved. And during one of the hearings, I guess it was Senator McIntyre from New Hampshire, was this guy, there was somebody from the ICI testifying, Robert Augenblick, which means wink, I think. Robert Augenblick, he was the president of the ICI. And Senator McIntyre said to him, now you're against putting a fiduciary duty into the statute, wouldn't you agree that there is a fiduciary duty on the part of an investment advisor? And so he said, yes, there is. So instead of amending Section 36 to make it that fees had to be reasonable, they put it in Section 15, I think, that fees had to be reasonable, and that they couldn't get that. But once Augenblick admitted there was a fiduciary duty, that's how we got Section 36B, which says that an advisor has a duty.
Is this related to the 22D?
No. Has a duty with respect to the amount of compensation. I think, I don't think it says fiduciary. I'm not sure. It doesn't say fiduciary. I'll have to look at it again.
There was a lot of gray area as far as how do you determine what is a reasonable.
Yeah. Well, now here's the thing that happened. We thought that that was a great coup, putting that in, getting that in 36B. Mm-hmm. But the courts went in and for, you know, and Deckard's clients are happy about this, and other law firms, the courts went in an entirely different direction from what we had predicted. When the and very few cases were litigated because people settled, and they settled by lowering the fee, putting in breakpoints, lowering the fee for a number of years, and then settling for cash. There were only a few litigated cases, and in the litigated cases, which I guess Gartenberg was the one that set the scene, although is the most cited precedent. Instead of focusing on what the advisor did and what was reasonable with respect to duty, and I'll add something to that. They focused on what the directors did, what they considered, what they looked at, whether they were diligent in analyzing the information they had gotten. And so the idea and the fact that, and if the director said, well, everybody's getting a half of 1% with no breakpoints, that's what we're going to do. For all practical purposes, that was okay. Hmm. Now, another word about reasonableness, when they were doing their formal statements introducing and supporting the 70 amendments, one of the senators, I think his son is a senator now too from Utah, Senator Robertson of Utah, I think. Anyway, he got up and he said, "These amendments provide a standard of reasonableness for advisory fees." And, you know, he couldn't have said it better for the commission, although it didn't do any good, because, as I said, the courts went in an entirely different direction. But I have always liked to believe in my, you know, in wearing my old SEC hat, mm-hmm. I've always liked to believe that Section 36B put a break or a cap on greediness on the part of investment advisors and made them be more circumspect in what they were doing, and it did a lot of good. Now, one of the interesting things is in my later work at the commission, I was on a task group of financial regulatory agencies, and I was the SEC representative, and he's right in this building. His office is right in the same floor as mine. The then chairman. It'll come to me. I believe the ICI's arguments that all 36B does is cost money because you have to hire lawyers and litigation is very, very expensive. And on a cost benefit basis, 36B is not worth it because it costs shareholders in legal fees more than it's worth. And when I heard and I heard that at this meeting of the representatives of the financial regulatory agencies, and we had gotten it from the ICI, and I went back to my office, and I did some research on the settlements, and I added up very quickly the dollars that funds had gotten in these settlements. And it was a very surprisingly large amount, not even counting the reduction in the advisory fees, but just the cash settlements. And so at the next meeting of this financial regulatory agencies group, I brought that up. And I said, look, this shows, and I also told Casey, he was the chairman. I also told Casey that the figures just go the other way on a cost-benefit analysis. And so he didn't object to my taking that position for the commission at these meetings. And then, could you just turn it off for a minute because I have to... Yeah, is it on? Okay, it was Breeden when he was chairman, Breeden was representing the vice president who was Bush Senior on this committee of. Financial services representatives, and he was the chair. He was a very effective chair. He would not let things go on. I mean, he was terrific. He would not let things go on, and he would just, you know, and we wrote a report, which is a fairly good report. It has some stuff in there about the 40 Act that really was not too bad, and about the advice. There's something in there that says that the commission takes the position that giving any advice about securities, even though it's not limited to specific securities, requires registration under the Act, under the Advisors Act. Mm-hmm. And so there's something in this report that says that ought to be changed.
If you're not giving advice about specific securities, then you don't have to be registered.
No. If you say the position of the commission then was, and I don't think it is anymore, if you tell somebody, although maybe some of the people who work for the commission do, if you're a broker, dealer, and you have a client and you say, or an insurance agent, here's what I think you need to do with your asset allocation. I think you need, and you have, your resources are $20,000 a month. I think you ought to put $10,000 into life insurance, $5,000 into real estate, and X dollars in securities. The position of the staff was then that if you did that, you had to register under the Advisors Act. And then the commission, now it's all coming back to me like a bad dream. And then the commission brought a case which I wrote the brief on and lost. And the name of the case was Low, the Low case. In the Low case, this is a guy who did newsletters. Yes, this is all coming together. This guy did newsletters, and he never made a specific, he rarely, if ever, made a specific recommendation about anything. And anyway, he didn't know, and he didn't tailor his advice to the specific needs of any client or customer. And the commission said that he had been kicked out of the advisor's business by the commission. And this was really a bad guy. This was a guy who stole some money from a customer and then did a settlement with the customer, and then tried to settle with the customer, and he brought a copy into the court that was a photocopy of a check that had $10,000 on it, except that he had altered the check. It was really for $1,000. And so the judge didn't take too kindly to that either. But this was the kind of guy we were dealing with. That cut no ice whatsoever.
Yeah.
And in the Low case, and I helped write the brief on that, the Second Circuit said, in order to register as an advisor, their service must be personalized. It has to be directed to the specific financial and other needs of the client. Now, the funny thing about that was, Lowe didn't make that argument. He just made a generalized, unconstitutional argument, and it was some association of journalists and writers who had written an amicus brief who took that position. And when I read the brief, I laughed, and I said, this guy must have dictated this into a dictating machine at 2 o'clock in the morning before he fell asleep. but that was the thing that won the day. That won the day.
Well, it was this idea that he was speaking in general terms through his newsletter. He wasn't endorsing.
Yeah, he was as a matter of fact, he may well have made. No, I'm sorry. Go back. He probably did make specific recommendations. But those recommendations were not specifically tailored to the needs of anybody. You could read the thing and you could take it or leave it. And there was no discretion involved, which is very important. And for example, when Money Market magazine first came out, the question was, and they had a lot of specific recommendations. It's a Time publication. I don't know whether it still existed. They made specific recommendations. But that was difficult to deal with because of First Amendment problems. And we finally worked it. We finally rationalized it by saying, you have to look at the overall context of the whole publication. You know, if that's all they do, then they obviously have to register. But if Money Market Magazine has one column among 50 pages or 30 pages, then that the overall tenor of the thing is not an advisory service. Mm-hmm. And that's how we dealt with it when I was chief counsel. Before even, well, I don't know. I'm getting my chronology mixed up, but that's what it is.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of chronology, let's jump back a little bit. Yeah. You mentioned briefly Phillips and Loomis did this 66 study
Right. Oh, there was a number of other people. I did a little bit on it.
Yeah, I'd like to know a little bit about what really caused that to happen. What precipitated that study in 66?
I think it could have been the Wharton study. I don't know. I wasn't really.
Okay.
I wasn't really.
So how did the project work? You said you did a little bit.
There was Lou Mendelson did the part on advisory fees, and I remember sharing an office with him before I became chief counsel when he was working on it, and he said, what would you think if you found out that banks charged, excuse me, 0.1% for managing trust funds, or 1%, and investment advisors to mutual funds charge 0.5% or 1%? What would you think of that? I think that's outrageous. That was the mindset that caused the thing to happen. Because if you look in the study, you'll find some things that illustrate that. As a matter of fact, one of the interesting things that happened at the hearings was the commission held up the Massachusetts Investment Trust as a model of management because they didn't have an external advisor. They had trustees who got a salary that I think was based somewhat on the size of the funds, but it was much less altogether than 0.5% or 1%. And so at the hearings, one of the senators or congressmen said, "You're holding up Massachusetts Financial Service or Massachusetts Investment Trust as a model, but you know, when I look at the compensation of these directors, it looks like an estate, not an annual salary." And that's the secret. And I always tell people the reason why, and that's an insight, the reason why investment advisors all can charge 0.5% or 1%, although things have drastically changed, really drastically changed, because you need a large staff now. It's very expensive. And I'm not saying that 0.5% or 1% is unreasonable. It depends. But at that time, the houses were, the advisors were much smaller, most of them, and so it was easy to say, "Oh, you got no break points. You're Dreyfus. Dreyfus has a billion dollars and no break points." P.S. Massachusetts Investors Trust later externalized, and they set up an advisory company, which became the advisor to the funds, and it's Massachusetts Financial Services.
They went the opposite way than what people would have expected.
Yeah. Now, you know. So,
the 66 study,
right?
How soon after that came out, did there begin to be a push for legislation? Did it seem like cause and effect? Or?
I think that it followed naturally from the report, you know, because there are recommendations in the report.
Right.
Were there not? Yes.
Did you testify or attend any of these hearings?
I attended virtually all of the hearings.
Hmm.
Yeah.
What was your function?
Oh, just to listen and find out what was said and to go back and to report and, you know, to see what we should be doing. Oh, and also very often, and if you look at the record, you'll find this. Very often senator or congressman would say, "Well, I want more details on this. I want you to write me a letter explaining all this in more detail." And so I would go back and I would help them, you know, write the letter. And as a matter of fact, it was the only case I have ever been authorized to send a letter to a congressional committee saying that someone had lied because of the fund of funds provision that Alan Mostoff did. I didn't had very little, if anything, to do with it. That's Section 12D severely limits fund of funds, and because there was a pyramiding of fees, and there was a lack of transparency, and. And then somebody, his name was Milton Mound, and he had a fund called First Multifund. And he was very tricky because, I know a little bit about the 33 Act. Under the 33 Act, the Act actually says if you file a registration statement, it becomes effective immediately, within 20 days, automatically. But then the commission felt that, you know, nobody really wanted to be caught making false statements or incomplete statements. So they have filed the delaying amendments, and then they formalized it even more. And they have, you have a system for doing that. And Milton Mann was very clever. Milton Mann used to file a registration statement, and he ignored all comments. And he just let them all become effective in 20 days.
But in that 20 days, right, he could do whatever he wanted.
Yeah. No, and thereafter, because they never went out. They never. And we actually had the nerve to file an exemptive application with the commission that the division vociferously opposed, and the commission gave it to him. So anyway, but I wrote a letter to the House committee, signed my own name to it. It said, "You need to know that Milton Mound lied to you when he said so and so." Didn't do any good.
Yeah. Well, we're talking about the 70 hearings and the 70 legislation, and you talked about how it's been characterized as accomplishing the 66 Stone accomplished little.
Yeah.
How accurate is that?
That's totally wrong. Totally wrong. It got us 12D and really severely limited. You know, pyramiding and lack of transparency. It got Section 36B that really has put a check on excessive fees. And it got a number of other things that clarified a number of other things.
What didn't it do? What are some of those things that one could say, well, it didn't take care of this, it didn't take care of this?
Well, it didn't really take care of distribution fees.
Is that 22?
And that's 12D1?
12B1.
Yeah, there was a separate internal study on that. And it was handed over ultimately to the NASD. At that time, there were two kinds of brokerage houses. There were NASD members that the NASD regulated, and non-NASD members that the SEC regulated. Ultimately, everybody had to register with the NASD, and when the SEC wanted the NASD to put a cap on distribution fees because it was 8.5%, and the front end. Oh, I'll tell you something else that it did. After I do this, the NASD said that it didn't have the authority, and the SEC. I don't know who did the negotiations. Probably somebody in the general counsel's office, and said. Or maybe market regulation said, "Nonsense, you have virtually plenary authority to regulate the conduct of your members, and you have the authority, and you're going to do it." And they did it.
Didn't want the authority,
yeah.
I guess.
Another thing that the 70 amendments did was kill what we then called front-end load plans, which I got annoyed at until I finally had to accept it. But there was a kind of plan. It was a periodic payment plan, and the periodic payment plan went something like this: you put in a minimum amount of money, And they took a half of it right off the top and gave it to the dealers. And then you got a reduced load for the following years, you know, maybe scaling down to 7%, 5%. Mm-hmm. And the 70 amendments killed that. And I'm not sure that we intended to kill it, but we hoped, I think we hoped to kill it, but we didn't realize how successful it would be. But we did it in a way that no one really could object to, which was disclosure. You had to disclose a lot. And the one thing that said that we had to set up reserves to pay back the money if people left early. Mm. And I will never forget, I think I put that in, I didn't draft it, but I had somebody draft, put it into the amendments that you had to have reserves. And I think Dick Phillips said, oh, we tried that, it'll never fly. And I think I persuaded, we put it in, and of course, it flew like a horrible monster because no one could do it. They didn't have the wherewithal to set up reserves for, disclosure was bad enough.
Mm-hmm. So that effectively got rid of all of those.
And actually, you know what it was? It was a fund that invested in a single fund and charged additional distribution fees.
A fund that invested in a single?
In a single, like there was the Dreyfus Fund periodic payment plan. And the brokers would sell it, and that's what they did. Hmm. And then there was another type that we also killed that did pretty much the same thing. I forget what they called it.
Following this legislation, is the process that the SEC then has to implement rules?
Yeah, we had to do rules. Actually, we did a series. I think there are seven releases that my office and I drafted that explained what it all meant.
Now, how do you come up with that stuff? Do you just sit around and think about it real hard and put it down on paper? Or?
No, I mean, there are ambiguities in the legislation, so
right.
We explain what it meant. And you'd have to go, and they were very useful releases because they did explain a lot of things.
Okay.
Like the true meaning of Section 12D1. That's the fund-to-fund thing.
Okay.
And some other things.
Well, the irony here is that as the mutual fund industry is really getting regulated in a fairly serious way, it's also running into some problems. There's a long period of net redemptions starting in the early 70s. Certainly.
Yeah, right.
What did that context have to do with the way you handled things?
Well, I think by the time they did the rules that allowed money to be taken out of the fund to finance distribution. Mm-hmm. And I was in the general counsel's office, and when I looked at it, and incidentally, divisions typically hate people in the general counsel's office who oversee their work, and so they used to keep me in the dark. Determinedly keep me in the dark until they sent their memo to the commission, and so that was one of them. And when I finally saw it, I said to Dick Grant, who wrote the rule.
Is this 12B1?
12B1. I'm sorry, misspoke. I said. this is terrible. You don't have any limits at all. There's no telling what would happen. Now, what happened, and what happened that I, at that point, never dreamed would happen was people would charge a load, and then they would charge a 12B1 fee on top of it. And I never thought that that you could do that. And as a matter of fact, another one of my close friends, Alan Mostoff, was at Deckard then, and he did the, as time went on, and he did the first exemptive application that allowed allowed the different types of shares to be sold, you know, the A shares and the V shares, mm-hmm. where you pay in advance a higher fee, and then it scales down according to a fixed, you know, plan. So he filed the first exemptive application for that.
So getting back to the question here, it was there a sense that you needed to help out the industry that is not doing
that was it. They were net redemption, and so they did these rules, and they had some criteria, okay, which may have been suitable at the time, because, you know, we'll charge taking money out of the fund of people who have already paid a sales load and won't pay any more. Is that for the best interest of the shareholders? Mm-hmm. And the answer then probably was, if you're in net redemption, yes, because it gets more assets into the fund, and with economies of scale, you can make the thing go. But I think no one would disagree that those criteria don't make any sense. And if it's been said once, it's been said 100 times in several reports, by a number of people, a number of organizations, including the Mutual Fund Directors Forum. I think they put that to the side, though. It was too hard. But I think they're going to come up with something. They're supposedly trying to come up with something now. And that was what happened. It's it's old law of unintended consequences in full cry.
Well, something else that's happening at that point is that the banks are trying to get in.
Yeah, right.
It seems to me that the SEC was essentially staying on the sidelines there.
This ended up with Graham Leach Bliley, and that was because the banks wanted to act as dealers and sell fund shares, and there was a big struggle over that, and there's an exemption in the act for certain kinds of trust funds, mostly corporate trust funds and other personal trust funds those pools don't have to be registered in the act, and the banks tried to get in under that, and the commission and staff fought vigorously against that. As a matter of fact, under Hamer Budge, they even sued Citibank, because Citibank put in an ad that said, in effect, come one, come all, we'll manage your money for a fee. And that was settled. It turned out that when the commission investigated, they had eight securities, and they aggregated them among the different trust funds in equal percentages. There was some variation depending on what the trust fund was, and so the commission settled that. And then I remember, when I was in general counsel's office, there was another one that had a similar ad. And I know Kathy McGrath wrote them a letter and said, you're out of your mind. You got to. If you do this, you have to register. So that ended up with Graham Leach Barley, which, as we speak, is still, those rules are still being developed, because the Division of Market Regulation, you know, has to deal with the bank regulators, mm-hmm. and they're pushing in one direction, and market regulations pushing in the other. And you know, they have this limited number of trades limitation, and whether salesmen have to be registered representatives of a broker-dealer, and whether you have to have a separately registered broker-dealer, and on and on and on. And that's not even settled to this day.
Right. It's been going on for a long time.
Right.
There's something I'm trying to put together.
Yeah.
In 72, let's see, the Congress asked the SEC to do a study on Section 22D.
Yeah.
At the same time, I see that you were involved in an industry advisory committee in 72. I'm wondering if those things were related at all.
I have no recollection.
Okay.
I have no recollection.
Yeah.
No recollection of that.
Do you remember being on an industry advisory committee clear back in that early day?
No, I just don't
Somebody
remember.
Somebody named Danforth was involved.
Sure. I will tell you more than you want to know about that.
Oh, excellent.
Okay, this is really good. Yeah, Danforth. We had it was an industry advisory committee, but it was not for the whole industry. It was just representatives of the industry. And what happened was William J. Casey, I always say of sainted memory, William J. Casey had found out that we were writing letters to people saying to brokers, you're trying to get people to put money in as free credit balances or cash balances, and then you will use your discretion to invest those balances, and you have to register. And I remember the Division of Market Regulation thought this was peachy fine, and I had some disagreement with them on that. And then, but I think we finally prevailed. And Casey was really, he was really bright. He was really clever. And so was Alan Mostoff. And Casey said to Mostoff, I think that this is the infancy of computers. I think that with computers now, you could do that. You could do some personalized services with a computer. And why don't you get together an advisory committee and see what you can work out? Well, I thought they had already chosen the representatives. There was somebody from Merrill Lynch. There was somebody from Citibank. There was somebody from someplace else. I can't remember. And somebody from T. Rowe Price. And I don't remember. I think there was a fifth one, I can't remember, and we did write a report about it, and I thought, oh, talk about putting the fox in the chicken coop, this is it. So,
and one person from the SEC, is that right?
What?
You from the SEC.
Right, although I had somebody who was really smart, his name was Peter Sullivan, he was really smart, I couldn't have done it without him. And then later, Michael Berenson, who is a partner at a firm here, who was working first unpaid, and then later we hired him because he came in and said, "I want to work for you," and I don't want any pay. I think it was probably illegal, but we did it. There's something called the augmentation statute. Government employee cannot augment their activities by government agents can't augment their activities without getting appropriations. In any event, so we went up to Danforth, who put ads in the paper that said, "Give me $5,000 and I will give you personalized service."
Who was Danforth?
He was just some guy in Connecticut, in some town in Connecticut. I forget where it was.
Okay.
But we knew who he was because he was on the committee, and he was doing the ads, and we had our eye out for him. So he went up there, and damned if he wasn't doing it. He was really doing it. And so then we had, and of course we had City, the guy from Citibank, that was Debevoise, I think. Debevoise was the counsel that we had sued. And so we had, oh, it was one thing about the advice, there's something called the Advisory Committee Act, and the Advisory Committee Act requires that the Advisory Committee have a charter which is published and approved by the agency, maybe even by the Office of Management and Budget. I don't remember. And the Advisory Committee Act required that all meetings of the Advisory Committee be in public, in the public. And we didn't want, you know, being these terrible government bureaucrats, we didn't want that. Well, fortunately, the Advisory Committee Act had about, I don't know, 3 or 4 months before it became effective, although we knew about it. And so we had to scramble to get the thing done before the Advisory Committee Act became effective, and we did it. And so so we came out pretty much, you know, sort of along the lines of what the low case stands for, which is you have to do personalized service. One of the things that was really difficult was, suppose you have 1,000 people, and you do questionnaires, and you get the profile of the people, what their needs are, and how much they should be putting to it. Suppose you have 100 people in this group, or maybe five different groups of 100 people with slightly different answers to questionnaires, and suppose you run them all the same. Is that an investment company? And ultimately, although I teased somebody who represented Blackstone, that went on to greater glory, I think they own the world now. I teased somebody who represented Blackstone, and he asked me that question, you know, suppose they all had the same, you had a number of people with the same profile, you ran them all the same way, and I said, no, that's going to really kill your client, because you can't do that. But it didn't turn out that way.
Well, other things that changed the industry in the 70s, money markets.
Yeah, right. Now, Marty Liebecker ran that. You know, we did a number of, we ultimately came out with a rule, which is the longest and hardest and most impenetrable rule you will find in certain respects. And Marty Liebecker, who was, I think he had been out teaching at Duke, and he came back to be an associate director of the division. There were a number of exemptive orders for money market funds, because the question was, you know, can you round up a penny, penny rounding, there's another method that escapes me at the moment, but he had a number of exemptive orders, and finally, when they had enough of them, they did a rule. Now the banking industry was really against this, and we had a series of hearings on that about whether the commission could allow money market funds, because they were losing deposits. And the money market funds paid a lot more in return than the banks could, because there were regulatory limits. I think there was 5% on deposits. Mm-hmm. But money market funds in a time of inflation could pay more. You know, they don't now, but right. I think they're approaching it again. So we had another fight, and we had a series of hearings on that. But we ultimately, prevailed.
I got just a few more questions.
Okay, sure.
One more time?
Boy, I've been talking continuously. 2 hours. Yeah.
Money market funds. Yeah. The other big thing that happened in the 70s was Vanguard.
Kind of
revolutionizing the business.
Right, yeah.
How did that affect the SEC's approach to all of this?
Well, I was heavily involved in that because Vanguard had an exemptive order that the commission ultimately granted to allow an in-house fund of funds. In other words, if all of the funds in this fund of funds were funds that you were the advisor to, then you could have it. And I remember Alana Peters was a commissioner, and I forget the other fellow. He was a red-haired fellow who died at a very young age.
I don't remember.
Anyway, so and so they and I wrote a memo from the general counsel's office that whoever was general counsel approved. It said that it was too soon. It was Congress had already provided these limits on funds of funds, and you couldn't just give it away. And moreover, we had serious doubts as to whether the commission could exempt itself from the requirements of Section 12D1 because they were allowing Vanguard to do something that, you know, they were not enforcing the law and giving this away. But anyway, so Alana, called me up and we talked about it. So I wrote this memo from the general counsel's office, and I also, they wrote a dissent, which by that time was unheard of, right? Totally unheard of. Although, you know, in the corporate governance area, you know, there have been a number of dissents from the independent director, independent chairman rule that have been published. But that was unheard of. They wrote a dissent from the commission's order giving Vanguard the authority to do this. So I think it has changed a lot. And, I don't think it's done any harm either because, you know, there is transparency. There's, you know, there's reporting. And you know what you're getting, and you're getting the prospectuses and so on. Yeah.
So you moved into the general counsel's office then, late 70s, working with Harvey Pitt and Farrar.
Yeah, right.
And I'm sure that you were doing more than just representing the Division of Investment Management.
Yeah.
What were some of the issues that were memorable of that part of your career going into the 1980s? The Reagan years.
Well, I wasn't representing the division at all.
You mentioned Harvey Pitt liked to have people in there.
Yeah, right, right. But I was doing what Harvey wanted and Ralph wanted.
For example, the 80s is the time when we're getting all the insider trading stuff going nuts. Right. Did that affect you?
I don't think that was an enforcement function. There was also the business development, company amendments, which I had a fairly large part in. I represented the commission in that, in dealing with the industry, and Kathy McGrath, who had a client who was very interested in having some relief from insider transaction prohibitions of the Act, Section 17D, Section 17A. And so I negotiated some of the details of that legislation, which is also impossible to understand. I see Marty Leibecker wrote the stuff. But anyway, but I seen his fine hand in that because I think that he had some view that, you know, it was so complicated no one could do it. I'm not speaking for Marty. This is just a suspicion I've had from time to time.
This is Business Development Company Amendment.
Yes, yeah, I think that's an 81.
Okay.
That's an 81, yeah.
Okay. All right. Anything else we should get on the record?
No, I will tell you something I have said before, but I'll say it again. When I was chief counsel of the division, I had an interpretive principle or rule, and that rule was, would I like it if they did it to my mother? And I hope that some of that feeling may have carried over into my work at Deckard, because Deckard is a fine law firm, and the financial services group is a great group, and we always counsel people to follow the law. We may help them to expand an interpretation a bit, but never over the line,
yeah.
I hope.
What was behind your decision to come to Deckard? You came here right from the SEC, is that right?
Oh, yes. I was approaching the age of 65, and I thought, gee, I'd like to retire. I'll find out what my benefits are. I think I was making $33,000 a year, and I found out that it would be a little less than half. And I said, I got to get out of here while I still look like I can do something. And so I had always kept up with Alan Mostoff and Alan, and we used to socialize. We went out to see, and I remember even the play. It was it was that play about Brooklyn and Coney Island that was popular. I forget, but anyway, we went out to see this play, and I said, Alan, I'm thinking of leaving the commission. And he said, oh, we have to do something. And so we did, ultimately. It took a little while because they were investigating one of the Deckard's clients, and we had to wait until that was over. If they settled that.
So you've been watching the SEC from the other side now.
Oh yeah, I was at the commission for 22 years, and I will be here in September 2007. I will be here 21 years.
Do you see the same commission that you were working for all that time?
Oh no! This is the commission that. Well, I don't want to denigrate them, but this is a commission that is not composed mainly of lawyers, as it was for many years, is not composed of people who are more sympathetic to the industry and to business than the other commissioners were. And, you know, and you can see it. You can see it in the tensions. You can see it in the corporate governance situation where, you know, the business roundtable sued and the commission lost. And so it's a lot different. And, you know, I don't question their integrity or their knowledgeability about the things that they're knowledgeable about, but it's an entirely different commission.
Yeah. Well, times have changed to some extent.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, thanks very much for talking.
Well, thank you.
And it was a lot of fun.
Oh, good.